And Russia accuses the U.S. and other Western powers of meddling in Ukraine since fall of the Soviet Union to force pro-Western policies in Kiev. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's leader says the West, including the U.S., is seeking the collapse of the Islamic Republic by backing the former Iraqi dictator during his war on the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said all world powers assisted Saddam Hussein in that war. He said France and Germany provided Saddam with weapons the most advanced. The leader underlined Syrian Arab states also helped the former Iraqi regime with financial aid and logistics. He said the Iranian families sacrificed sons and daughters to defend their beloved country. But leader added war made Iran stronger as the country succeeded in promoting the culture of resistance. He noted Iran's active presence in West Asia has been frightening for the U.S., its allies, and its puppets. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing a group of veterans and activists of the Iran-Iraq war and resistance just ahead of Sacred Defense Week. The Iranian president delivered his speech at the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Ebrahim Raisi says a new world order is taking shape and it will be irreversible.
We are at a determining juncture, a historic juncture. Today, the world is moving towards an emerging world, and this trend, this path is not reversible. The aging liberal order, which serves the interests of domineering powers, which used to serve their interests, it does not exist anymore. And in one word, the project to Americanize the world has failed.
Raisi said the world will not accept a Western hegemony any longer. Iranian president said some Western powers have a Cold War mentality and only want to seek the flames of conflict or stoke the flames of conflict. Said Iran has played a key role in foiling plots of hegemonic powers. Here he further said presence of foreign forces in West Asia creates insecurity and described the Israeli regime as the number one source of instability in the region. President also hailed anti-terror efforts of late Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January 2020.
The security today for some countries in our region, they owe their security to the struggles by martyr Soleimani. And if it hadn't been for the bravery of Lieutenant General Soleimani, he was a hero of fighting terrorism. If it hadn't been for his struggles, many regions would have burned in the fire set by the Daesh terrorist group.
Raisi said Iran will use all of its capacity to bring those to justice who are involved in General Soleimani's assassination. He also blamed Western countries for using terrorism as a tool to advance their foreign policy goals. Raisi said some European countries become safe havens for anti-terror groups such as, for anti-Tehran terror groups such as the MKO, which killed over 17,000 Iranians. He also condemned desecration of the Holy Quran and Islamophobia. He also stressed Iran will not give up its right to use peaceful nuclear technology.
Nuclear weapons have no place in Iran's defense doctrine. Official reports by relevant international authorities as well as Western intelligence agencies, they have time and again actually confirmed this claim, the authenticity of this claim. Iran, over the past two decades, has never ever given up its right to use and will never give up its right to use nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
The Iranian president played down impacts of U.S. sanctions on the country, highlighting failure of the maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration. Raisi also warned Europe will be a loser if it opts for a path of confrontation in dealing with the Islamic Republic over its nuclear case. Iran's defense minister says development of regional organizations such as Shanghai and BRICS shows world's inclination toward multilateralism. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani made the remark in a meeting with Russia's visiting Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. He said Iran opposes the presence of extra-regional forces as he's reviewing recent developments, especially those in the Caucasus. The Iranian general added maintaining territorial integrity of regional countries and international borders is one of the red lines of the Islamic Republic. Shoigu, for his part, stressed further strengthening of strategic partnership between the two in the defense sector.
We are aiming at implementing the entire range of planned activities despite opposition from the United States and its Western allies. Sanctions pressure on Russia and Iran shows its futility, while Russian-Iranian interaction is reaching a new level.
The Russian defense minister added that constructive cooperation between the two countries help will create stability and security in the region. Shoigu arrived in Iran, the capital, earlier Tuesday for talks with senior officials. Earlier today, he paid a visit to Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Aerospace Force exhibition, where he inspected Iran-made drones, missiles, and air defense systems. Independent researcher and author Greg Simons told us earlier why Iran-Russia defense cooperation angers Washington.
The U.S. is the architect of its own mispleasure and sorrow, because what it has been doing, it has been used to bullying one or two smaller countries, lesser powers than itself, for decades now. I mean, it's been bullying Iran, Cuba, North Korea, these different countries, which has been happening. But now, with this global transformation and this increased bullying of larger countries such as China and the Russian Federation, this moves things to a new level, because both of these countries, what they've understood is they're much stronger together in a united front against the United States. And this is why they're panicking at the moment, because they're a declining economic, military, and political power, and they've lost their absolute hegemony.
Families of victims of the 2018 terrorist attack in Iran's southern city of Ahvaz have filed a lawsuit against a number of U.S. officials and the administration for their role in the crime. Lawsuit has been submitted to a Tehran court. 32 high-ranking U.S. officials, including then-President Donald Trump, are among the defendants. According to a judge overseeing the case, two U.S.-backed separatist armed groups committed the act of terror, enjoying Washington's logistical support. Families of the martyrs are holding Washington accountable for abetting and equipping the terrorists. They're also demanding damages. 25 people, including a 4-year-old child, were killed and some 60 injured in the terrorist operation during a military parade in Ahvaz on September 2018. Iran's welcomed ceasefire agreement between the government of Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenian forces in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani made the remarks following a Russia-brokered ceasefire that will put an end to the latest clashes in the disputed region. Kanani said Iran expects two sides to focus on settlement of issues through dialogue and peaceful mechanisms within the framework of Azerbaijan's territorial integrity. He said Iran wants full respect for the territorial integrity of countries in the region and internationally recognizes borders. Kanani said the rights of ethnic Armenians in Karabakh must be ensured. He added any intervention by third parties in the region will only complicate existing issues and jeopardize the agreements reached so far. Russian foreign minister has accused Ukraine of violating UN charter by oppressing Russian-speaking population in eastern areas. Sergei Lavrov made the remark at a UN Security Council session held at the request of Albania. He also accused the U.S. and other Western powers of meddling in Ukrainian politics since fall of the Soviet Union to force pro-Western policies in Kiev. Lavrov defended Russia's veto power as legitimate, this as the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on the UN to strip Russia of its Security Council veto power, calling it a legal reform. He also denounced Moscow as a terrorist state, that is, adding war in Ukraine is a criminal and unprovoked aggression by Russia against Ukraine's territory and resources. As Ukraine continues to strike Crimea increasingly with NATO-supplied weapons and intelligence, Johnny Miller reports from the peninsula and finds many concerned that strikes could lead to a greater escalation.
Over recent months, Ukraine has been increasing strikes on Crimea. NATO is supplying weapons and intelligence. In turn, many Russians see this as a red line and are calling for harsher retaliation. many fear strikes in Crimea could lead to a dangerous escalation. The scenic grounds of the LaGuardia Palace in Yalta. It's here that the leaders of Britain, the US, and USSR met towards the end of the Second World War in order to shape the future peace.
When Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin were here in this palace discussing the future, their aim was to prevent any possible war in the future, never to repeat this horror called the Second World War. And now there is an idea to promote the Third World War, which should never be realized. Most Crimeans are Russian deep in their soul.
Just as peace in the last World War was outlined here, so another wider war is being risked over Crimea. It's thought that in the recent major strike on Sevastopol, missiles directly supplied by a NATO country were used. NATO politicians and the Ukrainian government continue to say that Crimea is Ukraine. Russia, of course, took control of the peninsula in 2014. But the inconvenient truth is that the vast majority of Crimeans want to be part of Russia.
I worry because if there's a strike in Sevastopol, then they could strike Yalta as well. I want Russia to be here. Crimea is Russia. We live a more comfortable life here as part of Russia. Because in Ukraine, our language rights were infringed. Our civil rights were infringed because we are all Russian-speaking population.
It's a big plus that we entered Russia. A lot was done for Crimea. They repaired a lot of roads, hospitals, and schools. That's a big plus. You could never see it in Ukraine. Take Sevastopol Highway. Earlier, it was never repaired. In Levadia, the local hospital was in a dreary state. But now we are satisfied with the way it looks.
NATO-backed strikes on Crimea are expected to increase, along with them the risk of a dangerous escalation. This despite the fact that the vast majority of people living in this scenic paradise just want peace. Jenny Miller, Crimea.
Senior Yemeni officials described as positive recent talks with Saudi Arabia, which were aimed at finding a way to end the war. Mahdi al-Mashat, who heads a Yemen Supreme Political Council, said the Yemeni delegation had received positive messages from the Saudi side. Mashat said he'll welcome the outcome of peace talks with Saudis if they're quickly implemented. The Yemeni official also stressed Sana'a's full commitment to efforts made to realize a just and inclusive peace. Now the talks, a first of their kind in past years, were held in Saudi capital Riyadh. Saudi Arabia has also held the positive results of the negotiations, saying they could help reach a roadmap for peace. This, as UN brokers, ceasefire is largely holding despite its official expiration last October. A Saudi war in Yemen started back in 2015 and has left thousands dead and millions displaced. Tens of thousands of senior and junior doctors working for UK's publicly funded National Health Service have once again walked off the job. Sai Purza is going to tell us why.
On the picket line again, up to 60,000 of England's junior doctors. What is different this time? They're joined by 20,000 of their senior counterparts for the first time, all asking to be paid what they deserve.
We do this with a heavy heart, but our salaries have been falling in real terms for 14 years. My salary in real terms is 35% lower than it was 14 years ago. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister refuses to talk with doctors about pay, and so I've been forced to do this.
Junior doctors are asking for a 35% restoration, while their senior counterparts are asking for an above-inflation pay rise. In July, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said there would be no more negotiations on pay and that the rise recommended by the so-called independent pay review body was final. Yet this, the doctors say, isn't just about pay. It's about the depressing state of the NHS. Junior doctor Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital in an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while a trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Said Pureza, London.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The hunt is on for survivors after at least six people died when a boat sank in the English Channel on Saturday, 12th of August. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us.
British newspaper The Observer has covered this story and tells us more. The government's controversial asylum policy faced renewed criticism on Saturday, 12th of August, when at least six people died after a small boat crossing the English Channel capsized and sank. Another two people are still believed to be missing after the sinking of the boat, prompting fresh calls for the government to urgently introduce safe routes for asylum seekers to prevent further tragedies. As the search for survivors continued, anger quickly switched to the Home Office's reluctance to introduce measures that would deter migrants from risking their lives crossing the world's busiest shipping lane. The tragedy also created a dreadful ending for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Small Boats Week, which was meant to reinvigorate his stuttering strategy to tackle channel crossings, but has been repeatedly marred by blunders and humiliation, including the forced evacuation of the BB Stockholm barge and record small boat arrivals. News of the latest tragedy emerged in the early hours of Saturday, 12th of August, when a passing ship raised the alarm that an overloaded boat was in difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France. In the hours that followed, British and French coast guards rescued about 65 people from the vessel. France's maritime prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said it believed two were possibly still missing at sea. Of those rescued, six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later died in hospital. The remaining five were taken on a boat but subsequently died. Reports from the French lifeboats arriving at the scene described numerous people in the area, many screaming for help. The Dover lifeboat quickly joined the rescue operation, with 10 survivors later seen being brought off the vessel as it returned to Kent, some on stretchers, though the extent of the injuries and exact numbers remained unclear. Enver Solomon, chief executive of the Refugee Council, said the latest preventable deaths underlined the need for the Home Office to act. These tragic incidents can and must be prevented. We know that people risk their lives to cross the English Channel as a direct consequence of safe routes being so limited and so ineffective. But instead of putting in place these routes and treating those seeking refuge with compassion and fairness, the government has introduced draconian and unworkable new laws that slams our door in the face of vulnerable men, women and children. Steve Smith, the chief executive of refugee charity Care for Calais, said the terrible loss of life demonstrates yet again the need for a system of safe passage to the United Kingdom for refugees. Later, the charity Freedom from Torture released a statement accusing ministers of hostile attitudes towards refugees. The current Home Office position pledges to bring in new routes, yet it is unclear when and in what form it would do so. We are committed to providing routes, including exploring new routes, to safety for vulnerable people crossing the globe. But we must first grip the rise in illegal migration and stop the boats, says the Home Office's website. Following Saturday's tragedy, a statement from the Home Office focused on tackling people smugglers rather than reviewing its current approach. This incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers business model and stop the boats, the website said. Britain's Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, chaired a meeting with Border Force officials on Saturday morning, 12th of August, and described the incident as a tragic loss of life. In France, an investigation has been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. The French National Assembly member for Calais, Pierre-Henri Dumont, said authorities were interviewing the migrants who were able to speak and not too unwell to establish what had happened and where they had come from. On Saturday night, rescuers were still scouring the water for survivors and bodies. A French Navy aircraft and a helicopter had been deployed to help in the search. On Thursday, 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats, the highest daily number so far this year, taking the total since 2018 past 100,000. Rescue crews said it was the seventh time last week that they had had to pull people from the water, Although the incident happened in French territory, it is normal for British and French rescue teams to work together to save as many people as possible. The sinking came just a day after fresh Home Office humiliation when asylum seekers on the BB Stockholm barge were evacuated following the discovery of Legionella bacteria in the water supply. The worst channel sinking involving migrants occurred in November of 2021 when at least 27 people died after a dinghy sank whilst heading to the United Kingdom from France. Four people died at sea while trying to cross the English Channel in December. The Home Office's position on safe and legal routes also says, as the illegal migration bill sets out, an annual number of people coming through on safe and legal routes will be set by Parliament and in consultation with local authorities. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. At least six people have died and more than 50 others rescued when a boat carrying migrants sank in the English Channel. British and French crews have been involved in the large-scale operation after a vessel got into difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France on Saturday morning, 12th of August. Around 65 people are thought to have boarded the boat, with two possibly still missing at sea, France's maritime prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said. Six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later was declared dead. An updated statement said the other five individuals who were taken in by boat had also died. A passing ship first raised the alarm that a vessel was sinking near Calais in the early hours of Saturday morning, 12th of August, the prefecture said. Some 22 people were rescued and dropped off in Dover, Kent, including by a Royal National Lifeboat Institution crew, which was launched shortly before 4 a.m. on Saturday, and a British chartered ship. At least 36 other survivors were collected by French boats and taken to the port of Calais, as well as five people who died. Home Secretary Suella Braverman chaired a meeting with Border Force officials later on Saturday morning, 12th of August, describing the incident as a tragic loss of life. Suella Braverman is being updated on latest developments in the operation. A British government spokesperson said these deaths are devastating and our thoughts are with the victims' families and friends at this time. The incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats, and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers' business model and stop the boats. Rescue teams from Folkestone and Langdon Bay, along with paramedics from South East Coast Ambulance Service, have also been sent to respond, the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency has confirmed. A French Navy aircraft and helicopter has been deployed, assisted by a number of boats and merchant vessels, a British chartered ship, and the British Coast Guard. An investigation has also been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. It comes after 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats on Thursday, the highest daily number so far this year, confirming the total since 2018 has surpassed 100,000. Some 343 people in six boats were detected crossing the Channel on Friday, according to Home Office figures.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies from all around the world, mothers, sisters, and every single one of you ladies from every corner of the world. Welcome back to a new episode of your favorite program, Muslim Lady. Well, I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host once more. And here we have Sister Zainab with us. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to the studio. Thank you. Well, I hereby have to offer my condolences to you, sister. And I know it's been quite a sad day for you. And for all of you who don't know what has happened in here, well, Sister Zainab has been through too much today. She lost her father, and we just pray for him, for his soul to rest in peace. For sure, he was a great man because he has such a great, wonderful girl. So I know it's going to be difficult for you, but again, it's a sign of your strength to be here.
Thank you so much for your condolences, and may Allah protect your nears and dears, everyone around. I'm here because of him. I dedicate this program to him, and because he has never taught me to stop in life, and I know he'll be more happy to be finding me in the studio rather than.
Thank you, really, sister. Thank you for coming to the studio. And as for your father, may he rest in peace. That's all we can say. And may God give you patience to tolerate the loss of your dear one.
Inshallah. The zakat of knowledge is to share it. So we're here for that, inshallah.
Exactly. And by the way, you are the symbol of practicing what you preach, because we have always been here talking about patience, talking about strength, but all of these things are pretty much easier said than done. And now I can see that you practice them in real world, which is not a very easy thing to do.
I don't have any right to sit here and preach if I do not practice it. So yeah, may Allah give us strength.
Yeah. So, dear ladies, I hope you don't get sad, but this is the way of life. You know, unfortunately, the more we escape from it, the more it gets close to us. And death is not the full stop. It's actually the end of a journey to start a new one, which is eternal and which is going to stay there forever. So as women, since we have got this heart full of emotions and passions, it's very difficult for us to cope with the idea of losing someone. And someone, it becomes the phobia of our nights. Every night when we get to the bed, we just start overthinking and overthinking. And then the negativity of this overthinking would kill us. So according to you, is there any way to fight this fear of losing your dear ones?
Well, there are so many ways to fight the fear, but the basic thing is to know the fear itself and the reasons behind the fear. Like, fear is a very natural human emotion. However, what is important is that it should not paralyze us or control us. That's important. And it can manifest itself in various areas of life, like in relationships. You fear to lose someone, in career, in the personal abilities, like you today have the ability of doing something, but tomorrow you don't. And it's all because of the attachment we have.
Exactly.
And especially when we have the fear of, like, losing someone, it's the emotional investment we have done. We are emotionally attached to things or people or our parents. Like, it's very natural. But since we invest our time, energy, and emotions, so it's really hard to get out of this attachment.
We actually invest our hearts.
Right.
Our hearts and our feelings.
Exactly. That's why I say we invest emotions, because they're all related to our heart. However, we have to realize we live in a practical world, and everything in this material world has an end. And there are some things that don't have an end. We've got to be focusing our attention on that particularly. Since I just lost someone very dear, my father, just today morning, I remember a very young boy who passed away, and then His mother was like, how should she convey this to her husband? They had this fear because this boy was ill for a long time, and then how she overcomes this fear and how she faces this tragedy is a good story. Like, she sees her husband coming back from a long journey, tired, and then gives everything to him, keeps herself prepared in the way she has to be in front of her husband, and then tries to talk to him, and she starts conversation like this. We had a majlis in home, and our neighbors lent me something to, you know, for that majlis, and now they're asking me to give it back. His husband says, yes, the thing that belongs to them, you have to give it back. She says, there was another neighbor coming in. She also lent me something, and she's also asking back for it. He says, yes, you know, how many times I shall tell you, whatever we take from someone, we have to give it back. She says to him, so, okay, then let me inform you. Allah had given us something, and we have to give it back to him. Inna Allahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Our son is no more. So yeah. This is the way she creates the beginning of, because this tragic event, what she's going through as a woman, how easy she made it for her husband to, you know.
Well, actually, to put it that way, needs too much of courage, strength, and too much of creed, I suppose.
That's why I shared this in Muslim Lady, because this was a lady who did that, and women do have that strength. And we all gain that strength from Lady Zainab, salam alayha, Lady Fatima, salam alayha, who have seen so many troubles in their lives, but they have never stopped.
Yeah, that's very true. So Lady Zainab, salam alayha, has been the paragon of patience, who teaches us, all the women from all around the world, the strength and patience that she actually shared in the most unbelievable tragedy of the world. So let's go for a short break, and then we'll be back for the rest of today's program.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Muslim Lady. I'm Asma, and Sister Zainab is here. Well, we talked about the loss of dear ones, which is very difficult. Well, theoretically, when you want to speak, you say that, okay, this is a mundane world. It's not going to stay forever. Everything has got an end. Okay, I agree with that. But then the attachment that we have, the emotional investment that you already talked about them, are very difficult to cope up with, and then to let go of them. Just the story that you said was a very beautiful story, but then in practice, it's very difficult. I mean, for us as the listeners, it's something incredible. And then it's not just the fear of losing someone that would actually engage my brain with itself as a woman. It's more than that. Actually, this is the most awful one. There are some other branches to the fear of losing. One of them is the fear of losing your beauty as a woman. We see that when women get older, some of them even get depressed to the point that they just go for different surgeries, and they go for different... I'm not talking about the coloring of the hair, because that's something pretty natural and it happens. But women do not want to believe that old age is just embracing them.
Well, the fear of losing beauty is not exclusive to women only, but men and women can both experience this fear. However, women do have this fear a lot.
Well, they have more attachment to their face, to their body, to all the beauty that all these years you've been working on them, protecting them.
So it's really important to analyze where it roots from, what creates this fear. It's a common concern that arises from the societal beauty standards. What are the beauty standards that your society has provided? And the emphasis is put on the physical appearance. There's what it roots from, basically. Because society often places a high value on physical appearance, on promoting certain beauty standards. And, you know, today we even have social media for that. This is a typical you know, this is a typical beauty standard.
Creator.
Right. Or like, this is a typical figure you should be having. This is a typical appearance you should be having, which really is not true. And this leads women to feel pressured to maintain their youthful appearance.
Exactly.
They undergo personal insecurities.
Like you feel you have been put in a competition and you must never lose that competition.
Right. And there lies another fear underneath the fear of losing beauty. That is the fear of aging.
Exactly.
That is the being judged based on the appearance. I'll be judged now. Oh my God, she has wrinkles. She has grown old.
Yeah.
That's how our society works like. So all these things contribute to this fear. However, it's important to note that beauty is subjective.
An old woman can be beautiful as well.
Right. It's transient. And actually, we have to understand what is beauty. I'm just talking about why women fear to lose beauty. What are the underlying reasons for that? It's natural desire to look and feel attractive. It's also important to recognize true beauty goes beyond physical appearance.
Exactly. Beauty is deeper skin.
Right. Shakespeare, in his sonnet 18, he addresses the transient nature of beauty by stating, every fair from fair sometime declines.
Yeah.
And we have seen it throughout his other sonnets as well, that he has understood the concept of
exactly.
Beauty fades with time. That's the beauty of physical appearance, actually. The physical beauty does fade away with time, and that's not something that's very important.
Exactly, yeah. This beauty getting faded away by time is a common moral of many sonnets of Shakespeare and even of all the poets throughout history. So before we get into more, let's go for another break and then we'll be back. All the things that we have attachment to, like our dear ones, like our beauty, like whatever that we have worked on in this world, we're going to lose them all in all. So there is a full stop for all of them. As we were talking about the loss, the fear of losing our beauty, we came to this point, how to just overcome it. So we got to this point that beauty is deepest gain and beauty is not this worldly thing that everybody sees on you. It's not just the dress that you wear and the face that is out of wrinkle. So let's define the real beauty.
True beauty does not lie in physical features. Rather, these features are basically subject to change. And we have to accept it as soon as possible. Otherwise, it will become difficult. The later we accept this fact, the difficult things will become for us. So we have to realize what real beauty is. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Jamalu fil lisan," beauty lies in your speech.
Yeah.
You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "La jamalu ahsanu min al aql." There's no beauty beautiful than your intellect.
Exactly.
Imam Ali alayhi salam again says, the beauty of a servant is in his obedience.
Yeah, submission to Allah.
Yes, the way you are submitting, the way you're obedient. Again, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the beauty of life is in contentment. So again, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, adorn yourself with a good character, for no beauty shines brighter than that of a good character.
I guess if we want to say the gist, we'd put it this way, that the soul is the thing that would stay forever. So the more you work on your soul, the less attachments you would feel. And then the more you would care about your personality, the less attachment you'd feel to your body or your physics or your face, whatever beauty that you have from the outside. So the most beautiful things that you have lay in your souls and in your character and your personality. So, yes, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you just found it fruitful. So, yeah, until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Economists have forecasted that UK retail savers will keep pulling funds out of investment funds this year as British householders struggle with inflation and rising mortgage costs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Financial Times has covered this story and tells us more. Deposits at the UK's four biggest banks have fallen by close to £80 billion over the past year as retail and corporate customers look for better interest rates, households grapple with higher costs and mortgage holders pay off loans early. According to an analysis of corporate filings by the British Daily, NatWest, Lloyds Bank, HSBC and Barclays experienced total outflows of about £78 billion in the 12 months to June 2023. That is the largest drop over four quarters since June of 2018, the most recent year for which data is available for all of the lenders. While the Big Four still hold close to £240 billion, more in deposits than they did in 2019, rival lenders' offer of higher interest rates is forcing them to improve their own deals. Benjamin Toms, analyst at RBC Capital Markets, said retail customers are migrating from current accounts at the large incumbent banks into savings or fixed-term deposits at some smaller peers, while the significant driver in the corporate space is the search for yield from corporate treasury departments. Benjamin Toms said smaller companies would also have repaid government-backed loans issued during the pandemic that had sat unused in their accounts. Toms added, retail customers have also been using surplus deposits to pay down debt, including both mortgages and credit cards, and generally manage their expenses as a result of a higher cost of living. Deposits began rising in the final quarter of 2019, jumping by nearly £80 billion in the second quarter of 2020 as pandemic curbs hit spending. They peaked at more than £1.5 trillion in second quarter of 2022. National Westminster Bank's major drop in the first quarter was partially due to technical reasons as it exited the Irish market. While smaller lenders benefited from the surge, deposits at the Big Four rose by 20% in the 4 years to June, almost twice the average of Santander, Virgin Money UK, Metro Bank and TSB. Holding larger deposits in a period of rising interest rates boosts banks' net interest margins, the difference between what they offer depositors and what they charge for loans. Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. With UK interest rates at a 15-year high of 5.25%, lenders have come under mounting pressure over their speed in passing on the benefits of higher interest rates to savers. The House of Commons Treasury Select Committee recently accused the Big Four banks of blatant profiteering by squeezing higher profits from their loyal savings customers, while the Financial Conduct Authority set a deadline for banks to justify low interest rates or face penalties. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, and the data watchdog also told lenders in July that they could communicate better saving rates to customers and follow data protection rules after banks raised concerns over compliance. High Street banks have responded by improving rates on instant access accounts, which now range from 1 to 1.75% compared with 0.7% to 1.35% a month ago. But they still lag rivals such as JP Morgan's Chase UK, which plans to increase its instant access savings rate to 4.1% in a few days' time. One senior executive at a smaller bank said that while rising living costs had contributed to the roughly £78 billion outflow, it had largely been driven by consumers withdrawing money to repay mortgages early in order to defray potential costs from higher rates. He said, "I think some people are saying, my mortgage is getting a bit expensive, but I've got all this cash in my bank, so they'll repay some or all of it depending on how much money they have." Bank of England data published recently showed that the effective interest rate, the actual interest rate paid on outstanding mortgages, increased by 0.1 percentage point in June to 2.92%. The average two-year tracker rate is now at 6.18%. The central bank also found that households withdrew a net £8.4 billion from instant access site accounts offering interest in June, while they put a net £6.6 billion into more competitive longer-term fixed-rate products, which are more costly to banks as the margin is smaller. Katie Murray, National Westminster Bank's chief financial officer, said at the bank's half-year results in July that a greater move to interest-bearing assets and competition in mortgages was behind its cut to its net interest margin guidance. The Bloomberg news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Economists forecasted that UK retail savers will keep pulling funds out of investment funds this year as householders struggle with inflation and rising mortgage costs. Data from the Investment Association, a trade body, showed that in June, retail investors pulled some £986 million from equity and fixed income funds. This represented the first net outflow by retail investors since December of last year. As rising interest rates drove growing interest in fixed income, investors focused strongly on UK government bonds, with overall net flows into gilt funds in June at £504 million, compared with a net inflow of just £126 million across all bond funds, including gilts. Cuthbert Hopkinson, a portfolio manager at Waverton Investment Management, said, "We have had a few clients take money out of their portfolios to pay off mortgages." He said people were concerned about rising costs, but higher interest rates were starting to push down inflation. High rates and the risk of a slowdown in Britain's economy this year have weighed on retail investors as they deal with the trickiest market conditions in more than a decade. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee recently raised interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point to 5.25%, in a sign that central bankers remained wary of stubbornly high inflation, despite price increases falling more than expected to 7.9% in June. However, interest rates nearing expected peaks will offer little reprieve to mortgage holders scheduled to renew at levels far higher than experienced in the past decade. According to data provider MoneyFacts, the average five-year fixed mortgage reached 6.37% ahead of recent interest rate hike. Rachel Winter, a partner at wealth manager Killick & Co, said, "It's about making a logical decision. If you're paying 6 or 7% on a mortgage, it's better to pay that off because you can't get that return on an investment at the moment." Cuthbert Hopkinson said that the deposit saving rates were also a draw for investors, as well as short-term gilts and corporate bonds. But he argued equities remained a more effective long-term hedge against inflation.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Deadlines. President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran expects the U.S. and Europe to fulfill their commitments under the 2015 deal and prove their goodwill in this regard. Iran strongly condemns a joint statement by the U.S. and Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, reasserting its sovereignty